beautiful tomb. He was not someone else, though. He was Ranefer, the son of Thutra, who loved his pharaoh and the gods of Egypt and wanted to be free. He took a deep breath and opened the gate. Gebu's Shenti was only a faint glimmering in the dark street ahead, but Ranefer waited until it almost disappeared before he ventured out. Keeping the pale blur just in sight, he followed it through the winding, narrow alleyways of the City of the Dead and across the barren land beyond, while the sky above him turned faintly gray and the stars vanished one by one. By the time the high western cliffs were stained with the first pink of dawn, he was moving along directly below them, with the city, the lower fields, and the strip of desert all behind. Presently, Gebu vanished into a cleft in the rock face, and when Ranefer arrived at the same spot a few moments later, he saw a winding pathway, strewn with boulders and hardly wider than a man's body, leading upward into the hills. He moved up it nervously, not liking the sharp curves which prevented him from keeping Gebu in sight in order to assure a safe distance between them, not liking at all the walls that pressed in on either hand with no crevices in which a boy might hide. He had passed the seventh curve and was still climbing when he heard a mutter of voices ahead. Gebu must have arrived at the meeting place and found Wenamun waiting. Or had he encountered a guard? Ranefer crept closer, listening. "May regret this day, impatient one." It was Wenamun's murmuring voice, that was certain. Gebu's lashed back at once. "Fool, who would follow us? Even the guards of the valley will be feasting in Thebes." There was another murmur, then Gebu snapped. "You are witless and a coward. Go look back down the path if you must." Ranefer went numb. As a footstep crunched just around the curve ahead, he whirled and scrambled straight up the rocky wall, seizing at cracks, minute tufts of grass, whatever he could get a hold of, and expecting every instant to feel a rough hand grasp his shenty. There was a narrow shelf formed by an outthrust boulder just above the height of a man's head. Ranefer rolled himself onto it and lay as still as death. The next instant, Wenamun's cloak-wrapped figure appeared around the bend. The mason stopped, his bright, suspicious eyes darting every way but upward. He advanced soundlessly, passing so close under the shelf that Ranefer could have touched the black plaits of his hair. He padded down to the lower curve, peered around it and listened a long moment, while Ranefer lay rigid and sweating in plain sight above him. Then he turned, retraced his steps, and vanished around the rocks ahead. It was some time before Ranefer could gather strength to slide down the path, and when he did, his legs were almost too weak to support him. Nevertheless, he forced them to move in the direction Wenamun had taken. In view of the miracle just passed, he could almost believe the gods were protecting him. The next bend disclosed the place of the broken tree, a wide spot in the canyon-like path, where a scrawny, strange-looking tree grew out of the cleft between boulders. Beyond, Gebu's hulking back and Wenamun's stooped, narrow one were just disappearing over a last rise. Ranefer could see now that the rise formed the summit of the western cliffs, up the furrowed and craggy face of which they had been climbing. To the east lay Thebes, spread on both sides of the swollen river like a many-figured carpet, stained in 100 delicate colors by the morning light. Beyond the rise to the west, the way opened out of the path and descended into the valley. Ranefer paused a moment, looking back upon the spread-out city. As he watched, 7 red and white pennants rose simultaneously on the palace walls, and he caught the faint, squealing notes of a trumpet. It was the signal for the festival to begin. Soon the great procession would burst from the gates of the Temple of Amun far across the river. Later, at midday, Pharaoh would come from his palace to throw open the first canal with his own hand, and the streets of Thebes would be full of flood-laden tables and joyful people and spilled barley beer. And he would not be there. Perhaps he would never be there again. Ranefer wanted nothing more in that moment than to be back in the street of the Crooked Dog, or even in the stone-cutting shop scrubbing at some block of granite with his sandstone, or chipping at a coffin lid. He bit his lip hard, turned abruptly away from the city that was his world, and started down the stony path into a world inhabited only by the dead. It stretched before him, a wasteland of glaring red hills rising from a giant's block pile of tumbled boulders, desolate, barren, and ominously still. Nowhere was there a single sprig of green. The sun had cleared the horizon now. By the time he reached the valley floor, it was beating fiercely upon his naked shoulders, reheating rocks and sands not yet cooled from yesterday, wrapping the whole valley of the tombs in shimmering, burning heat. Ranefer, threading his way among the scorching rocks, wondered in panic if he would ever be able to find his way out again. Every pile of boulders looked like every other. The cool, flooding Nile and the familiar streets of Thebes seemed as far away as stars. High above him in the brazen sky, a lone falcon wheeled. Far ahead, the figures of Gebu and Wenamun were dwarfed by their surroundings to mere swatches of black and white. Two thieves, a falcon and himself. Except for these, not a living thing stirred in all this burning, silent world. Other things stirred, though. Wraith-like things, unseen, unheard, but present in their hordes even in this glaring daylight. The Baas of the dead could roam by day as well as by night, if they so chose. And would they not often wing about this lonely city of their mansions, assuring themselves that all was safe and undisturbed? Surely a footstep, sounding faintly in their dwellings far below, would bring them fluttering in anger up their shafts into this hot, stiff air, set them searching this way and that for the intruder. Licking his parched lips, Ranefer tiptoed nervously across the sands, wondering if even now he was treading over the hidden chambers of some long-dead pharaoh and rousing his outraged Ba. He jumped as he heard the faint seven-noted cry of the falcon and stood with pounding heart, watching it soar away toward the south. When he turned back, the two figures ahead of him had vanished without a trace. In consternation, he scanned the cluster of rocks where he had seen them only a moment before, then broke into a run. Even their dubious company was preferable to the death-haunted emptiness which surrounded him now. Apprehensive and breathless, he arrived at the rock pile, stopped short, and sprang back behind it. Not 3 paces away on the other side of the rocks were the two he followed, working busily at something he had not time to make out. He stood flattened against a hot boulder, trying to control his jerky breathing. He could hear crunching and scraping, an occasional guttural curse. Then the noises stopped and all was still. Moments later, he dared peer out around the boulder. What he saw was an irregular black crevice in the rocks ahead, and a scattering of small stones around a large one, which had evidently been rolled aside. Was this the entrance to the tomb, then? It looked barely large enough to admit a man's body, much less the huge coffin that must lie somewhere below. Ranefer crept out of hiding and stood peering fearfully into the crevice. It did not look like any tomb entrance he had ever seen or heard of. Casting a nervous glance over his shoulder at the desolate valley, in which he was now utterly alone, he lay down flat on the hot sand and lowered his head into the dark, irregular hole. He could see nothing for a moment. Then a dimly glimpsed surface made him stretch an arm down to explore it. It was a narrow projection, perhaps a step. Wriggling forward, he eased more of himself over the edge until he was hanging head downward into the hole, with the edge cutting his wrist. His groping hand touched a second projection, not quite an arm's length below the first. Another step. It was certainly an entrance of some sort. This flight of crude and uneven steps, hacked out of the rock and earth, led down the shaft. At the bottom, a passage must tunnel away toward the tomb. Ranefer wriggled backward again and got to his feet, threw another uneasy glance around him, and turned back to the crevice. He could not make it out. Never could a huge coffin have been carried down that shaft. It must be a second entrance to the tomb, a secret one. A secret one, of course! He stood transfixed by a flash of understanding. The whole of Gebu's plot was suddenly clear to him. He had heard tales of such tunnels, dug out during the construction of a tomb by scheming workers. They would hack through the wall of a tomb chamber secretly, and tunnel as far as time allowed toward the surface of the earth, adding the rock chips to the other debris from the excavation of the tomb. The hole in the chamber wall would then be plastered over like the other walls, so that no passage showed at all. A few years or perhaps months later, when the funerary visits of the surviving family became infrequent, they had only to dig a shaft down from the surface to meet their tunnel. When this was done, they could enter the tomb at their leisure and cart away the gold, undetected by the guards at the real entrance, which might be a quarter of a league away and out of sight behind some rocky hillock. Gebu was a stonecutter, Wenamun a mason. They had done this thing. It would be easy for them to arrange it. Ranefer caught his breath as another realization struck him. The little room in the tomb drawing, the one for Pharaoh's master of storehouses, it was no room at all. It was a passage like this, disguised so that the workmen could hack it out without knowing it was anything but another storage chamber. Small wonder Gebu had flown into a rage when he was asked about it. Ranefer went cold all over with fright as he saw himself calmly pointing to that very place on the drawing, recklessly asking the most dangerous of all questions. It was like crawling straight into a crocodile's jaws and only finding out later that you had done it. Shaken as much by the past danger as by the present one, he huddled beside the crevice trying to gather his scattered wits. Poor master of storehouses, he thought distractedly. When the old man finally dies, he will not have long to rest. A sudden queer noise made him swing around. What was it? He saw no one, nothing, only the same glaring, lifeless wasteland, with its tumbled piles of boulders stretching all around him. His eyes went slowly to the rock pile near at hand, behind which he had hidden a few moments ago. Was something else hidden there now? He edged closer to the crevice, still staring at the rock pile. Once more, even Gebu and Wenamun seemed companions fervently to be desired. At least they were human. They were alive. But I do not want to go into a tomb, Ranefer thought desperately. I do not want to follow them clear into that dark and awful place. Surely it is enough that I know they are there. I can run now and give the alarm. Run past that ominous rock pile? Through all that terrible empty valley again? Alone? His flesh crawled. He shrank another step forward the crevice, and as he did so, he heard the sound again, eerily distinct and close. It was the dry rustling of wings. A cold moisture chilled Ranefer's forehead, as if an icy hand had been laid there. At that moment, a gust of wind swept across the sands. There was a loud clapping and beating, and from behind the rock pile, a huge black form with outstretched wings rose cumbersomely, tilting and flapping directly toward him. With a cry, Ranefer leaped for the crevice and slid feet first into the dark. At dawn, Hecate and the Ancient had arrived at the fish dock, dressed in their best and eager for the day ahead. For a time, they talked together happily, admiring each other's finery, teasing, laughing from sheer excitement, and glancing up the thoroughfare from time to time to see if Ranefer was in sight.
"What a lazy clod," Hecate said finally. "Still on his mat, today of all days. Let's go rouse him."
"Do you know where he lives?" inquired the ancient.
"Nay, I thought you might."
"Well, I do not. We'll have to walk."
They busied themselves watching more and more holidaymakers emerge from houses and side streets as the sky pinkened above. The sound of voices and laughter swelled, and the thoroughfare grew crowded as the inhabitants of the City of the Dead streamed into it and hurried toward the ferry landings. Still, Ranefer did not come. Many other boys passed by, with their parents and their sisters and their aunts and cousins and grandfathers. Gilded palanquins and chariots, preceded by runners and followed by retinues of servants, began to appear from the direction of the noblemen's villas. Ferry boats and private barks were now putting out from every dock as fast as they could be loaded. Many had already reached the opposite bank, and others were strung across the river like a gala chain. The two friends waiting on the fish dock began to get restive. When the seven pennants rose high on the palace walls and the trumpet squealed its joyful signal, Hecate turned impatiently to the ancient.
"Surely he will hear that," Hecate said. "Though he be sleeping like a rock, that sound will rouse him. He must come soon."
"Aye," the ancient said in a somewhat dubious voice. "But I do not understand why he is not here already."
"Well, anyone can oversleep. On a festival day? An always hungry boy?"
Hecate shrugged, but his face was puzzled as he peered down the crowded thoroughfare in the direction from which Ranefer must come. 10 minutes later, the crowds had noticeably diminished as they drained from the thoroughfare into the ferries and sailed across the river. Hecate and the ancient were now frowning and uneasy.
"We will miss our ferry," Hecate exclaimed. "They will all be gone soon. Did he not say he would meet us here? I know he said it. We spoke of it 100 times. Of course, I did not see him after midday yesterday."
"I did," said the ancient.
"And did he not mention any change of plans?"
"Nay, he..."
The ancient's face altered suddenly. He turned and stared down the street as if staring alone would make Ranefer appear.
"What is wrong, ancient?" Hecate asked anxiously.
"Perhaps nothing. Perhaps a great deal. Tell me, young one, did he seem disturbed when you saw him at midday? Did he act a little strange, as if..."
"As if what?"
Hecate prompted as the ancient's voice trailed off.
"I do not know," the old man admitted. "I know only that when I saw him at the day's end, I asked 3 times what ailed him. He was troubled about something, very troubled."
"It was that brother of his, no doubt," Hecate said. "He is always troubled about that brother and his thieving."
"Nay, he kept talking about tomb robbers. He..."
The ancient broke off with his mouth still open. For a moment, he and Hecate stared aghast at each other.
"Tomb robbers," Hecate whispered. "Could he have found out Gebu is a tomb robber?"
"He had found out nothing at all, so far as I know,"
the ancient said agitatedly.
"He told me nothing, but then perhaps he would not."
"Surely he would have told you that.
Still, he keeps his thoughts to himself, especially the bad ones, the ones that make him afraid."
Hecate's voice trailed off, too.
"Now what?"
"Yesterday, at midday, I was telling him something. I had overheard a conversation. I thought he was frightened. But then he spoke so calmly, told me it all meant nothing."
The ancient seized his arm.
"What conversation? What was it you overheard?"
Swiftly, Hecate repeated the tale of his eavesdropping behind the potter's new-made jars and what Ranefer had said of it later. When he mentioned the place of the broken tree, the ancient's one eye sharpened suddenly, but he did not interrupt, though his face grew grimmer and paler as he listened.
"So you see," Hecate finished, "it could have nothing to do with Ranefer. Gebu is not even in Thebes today. No doubt those two cursed ones are meeting, but at that place of the tree, and if that is in Abydos..."
"It is not in Abydos," said the ancient softly. "I know the place of the broken tree. It is an old, old landmark, but it is not in Abydos."
His bony hand stretched out, a finger pointing toward the western cliffs.
"It is there, near the summit, on the path to the Valley of the Tombs."
As Hecate eyed him in frozen silence, he added, "That young one knew it too, or guessed it. He asked me how those thieves were caught, the ones we saw hanging from the palace wall one day.
I told him.
"What did you tell him? How were they caught?"
"They were followed, straight through the valley and into the tomb. And I told him about it. I'll wager that's where he is this minute, trailing those villains across that place, with never a charm or an amulet to keep the cats away."
"We must go after him," Hecate cried. "We can catch him, Ancient. Bring him back."
The Ancient was already hobbling down the steps of the fish dock, his one eye fixed on the distant cliffs.
"Aye, we'll catch him if we can." "You're too young and I'm too old for such a venture, little one. But he's got nobody else."
"The guards?"
puffed Hecate as they ran into the thoroughfare.
"Feasting yonder, across the river, with everyone else."
The ancient pointed bitterly toward midstream, where the last crowded ferry boat was bobbing toward the opposite bank. The thoroughfare was deserted. All the streets were deserted, and the shops and houses empty. It really did seem a city of the dead now. At its outskirts, they were forced to slacken their pace. Both were breathless, as much from anxiety as from their haste. The ancient signaled for a halt, and they stood puffing, the eyes of both following the road across the desert. As soon as their breathing quieted, the ancient glanced at Hecate and nodded. Without a word, they started toward the western cliffs. Half an hour later, they rounded a bend on the steep, narrow path, and saw the strange, stunted tree thrusting out of the cleft in the boulders. Beside it, the path broadened, and Hecate caught up to walk beside the ancient. Together they topped the last rise and paused, blazing in silence out over the vast red wasteland that spread below. Hecate shivered slightly and moved toward the ancient until their arms were touching.
"How can we find him in that place?" he whispered. "Do you think we can find him, Ancient?"
"I don't know, young one. We must try.
I thought we might see him, but I see nothing, nothing alive."
"One thing is alive," the old man said grimly.
He pointed far across the boulder-strewn sands, from where a distant rock pile, a great black vulture at that moment rose clumsily, tilting, flapping, and finally wheeling upward in a soaring glide. When it was high in the air, circling lazily against the blue, the two on the cliff path tore their eyes from it and stared downward to the valley floor. Chapter 14 Ranefer's plunge into the crevice sent him half-falling, half-jumping from one to another of the crude, wide-spaced steps. After a moment, he missed one altogether and simply tumbled, striking his knees and wildly waving arms on every rough projection he passed. He landed at the bottom, feeling bruised, dazed, and as terrified of the inky blackness around him now as he was of the great winged thing from which he had fled. He got to his feet and stumbled about blindly, hands outstretched, until he located the opening of the passage he had guessed was there. It sloped gently downward as it led away into the unknown dark. As he hesitated, eyes stretched wide in a futile effort to see something, anything, a dim glow of light shone far ahead of him. Gebu and Wenamun must have kindled a torch. That glow was its faint reflection on some distant curve of the passage wall. Ranefer fixed his gaze on it, licking his trembling lips. He could not stay here shivering and dreading. He must follow, or else climb back to the surface and be carried off to some unthinkable land of Kefts by that great winged thing. He was still weighing bad against worse when the dim glow ahead faded and disappeared. Setting his teeth hard, Ranefer started along the passage. It sloped gently at first, then more steeply, leading even deeper into the earth, growing blacker and still blacker until Ranefer was seized by the conviction that he was moving along a slim bridge over vast empty space, and repeatedly clutching in panic at the walls while his bare toes fearfully explored the step ahead. The floor was strewn with sharp fragments that hurt his feet. The air was hot and close, and so dry it seemed to shrivel his very flesh. It was shriveling, he was sure of it. Was it from the breath of that great black creature still after him, or the deathly withering wind of its wings? He moved faster, scrambling blindly forward, longing for another glimpse of that light. Once his head struck sharply against something hard and rough-edged, and he sank into a terrified heap, whispering prayers to the vengeful spirits and spells against them. He was too weak to run, too frightened to stay where he was. Stumbling to his feet, arms locked about his head, he bumped the same hard thing again and realized it was the ceiling of the passage, pressing so low that from here on he would have to crawl. He crawled, his teeth chattering and his whole body shaking so uncontrollably that it felt as if it belonged to someone else. He had never felt so small, so alone, so outnumbered, as in this terrible black place haunted by beings he could not see or hear or feel, but only knew were there. Worse, every inch he moved forward took him nearer to an even more terrible place, the citadel of death itself, the dwelling of the outraged departed one, whose mere sentries these other creatures were. Now and then he caught sight of the torch glow ahead and flung himself recklessly toward it, though the faint, far-off gleam only intensified the blackness that enclosed him. Any living human, thieves and murderers included, Gebu included, would seem a friend and rescuer now. After what seemed an eternity, he realized that the blackness around him was no longer entirely black. It had turned to the lesser dark of night. Presently, it became almost grayish, so that he could see faintly the hacked-out walls on either side. Obviously, the torch had stopped moving, and he was drawing closer to the light. There was a sudden sound of chipping, followed by the noise of falling plaster. Ranefer halted, his desire for Gebu's companionship abruptly vanishing. Even the fear of bodiless devils gave way before the sudden clear picture of this all-too-solid one up ahead. Gebu was still Gebu, human or not, and he was at this moment breaking through the plastered wall of a tomb. Ranefer waited until all sounds had ceased and the torch glow moved on before he cautiously crept ahead. Around a bend in the passage, he was suddenly dazzled by a patch of golden light. He flung up his hand, blinking until his eyes grew accustomed to what seemed a brilliant glare, though it was only the torchlight shining directly through an irregular hole in the wall. Even as his vision adjusted, the glare dimmed. The torch was being carried farther into the interior of the tomb. He could see that now, as he had expected, the opening ahead of him was jagged with broken plaster. He eyed it fearfully, rubbing his cold hands against his thighs. For the first time, he wondered who the man had been that now lay buried here. Some great one, for the tomb was large. The torch had receded into what was apparently a second chamber, and the thieves' footsteps came echoing back to Ranefer eerily, as though in a vast space. His flesh crawled, and the little hairs prickled on the back of his neck as he edged slowly toward the hole in the wall. Shivering, he rose to his feet before it, peered fearfully in, and found himself staring into a pair of strange, glazed eyes, not 2 paces from his own. With a gasp, he flung himself backward, eyes tight shut against the horror that was sure to strike him dead. At the same moment, a voice growled, "Who was that?" "Ancient," Hecate said in a weary voice. "Perhaps he is not even in this valley." "Perhaps not," said the old man in a voice even warier. "Perhaps he followed Gebu somewhere on a boat, or to the stone-cutting shop, or..." Hecate sighed and did not bother to finish. "It is possible," said the ancient. They were leaning against a huge boulder near a heap of rubble that spoke silently of the entrance to a tomb somewhere nearby. They had investigated 12 such rubble heaps, prowled and searched until they had located a few of the tomb entrances themselves, though all were well camouflaged behind rocks and piled up sand. Not one had shown a sign of having been disturbed or even visited in years, and the few actual doors they had glimpsed after careful peering between the rocks had revealed the necropolis priest's seal unbroken on the jamb. They had located this near one too, and it too had disappointed and discouraged them. It was beginning to seem useless to keep up a search so futile in a place so vast. They had wandered far north of the rock pile from which they had seen the vulture rise. No doubt there were just as many tombs to the south of it. There were tombs all over the valley, 12, perhaps 100 of them. "Surely we would have caught sight of him before now, if he is here," Hecate said. "Unless he has..." He turned to the ancient with startled eyes. "Unless he has actually gone into a tomb. If he has done that, I fear it is too late for any help of ours," the ancient said grimly. "Do you think he would have, ancient?" "Nay, surely not," the old man muttered. He moved away from the boulder and glanced around him uneasily. "This valley itself is bad enough, with a keft watching from behind every rock, as like or not, to see what we are up to. I do not care over much for it myself." "Nor I," Hecate agreed with feeling. "And to enter a tomb with those two for company, that would be worse by far. I cannot believe he would do it. Come, boy, let us go back to Thebes. Perhaps we will find him waiting." Hecate nodded, but his nod carried no more conviction than did the ancient's voice. They started drearily back the way they had come, through the sand and glaring rocks, each one radiant with heat. Hecate stumbled and put both hands up to shade his eyes a little from the blinding light. "Ancient," he said in a small and dismal voice, "how do we know that brother of his has not done something to him? Maybe hours ago, maybe even last night." "We do not know," said the ancient. He too shaded his one eye for a moment to locate the distant cleft in the hill that marked the path back to Thebes. Then he lowered his head and hobbled on. There was a silence that seemed as long as time itself to Ranefer, who lay in a tight ball, dizzy with fright, on the floor of the passage. Then he heard Gebu's voice in the second room, sounding unconcerned as ever. "It was nothing, son of the jackal, son of a pig. You're afraid of your own shadow." "I tell you I heard a sound," the voice of Wenamun insisted. "There is no one here but us and the dead. Make haste with those boxes, now." Slowly, uncertainly, Ranefer rose to his knees, then stood. No one here? But what was that face he had seen? Trembling, he peered again through the opening and met the same pair of eyes. This time, though he shrank back involuntarily, he realized that they did not move, did not live. They were the inlaid glass eyes of a life-sized wooden statue, and he saw now that they had been partially smashed, as if from the blow of a dagger hilt. Gebu and Wenamun had wanted no gaze upon them as they went about their evil work, especially the gaze of this watchful Ushabti placed here as servant and guardian of the dead. Nervously, Ronefer examined the figure more closely, and his fear of its vengeance changed into an unexpected pity. It was the statue of a slim and lovely servant girl, wearing a painted white dress and painted gilt necklace, steadying a box on one shoulder and carrying a painted wooden duck by its feet in her other hand. Her expression was one of serenity and joy, and the sculptor who carved her had been a master. Now her clear, wide eyes were cloudy and blinded by the blow that had splintered them. Her beauty was marred, and her usefulness as a watchful guardian ended. It was like seeing some innocent, happy creature lying murdered, victim of Gebu's callous greed. Ronefer's gaze turned from her to move in wonder about the rest of the chamber, which was dimly illuminated by the glow of the torch from the next room. As he looked, a strange emotion took possession of him. Beyond and around the graceful statue were articles of household furniture, arranged as in a beautiful home. There were armchairs and beds of carved wood decorated with gold. There were alabaster honey jars, painted boxes resting on delicately wrought ivory legs. There was a wicker trunk ventilated by little slatted openings, through which the fragrance of the perfumed garments within escaped into the room. There were wine cups arranged on shelves. There were scent jars and jeweled collars and armbands. Everywhere was the gleam of gold. It was not the gold, however, that held Ronefer's gaze and drew him slowly through the jagged entrance to stand, silent and awed, within the precious habitation. It was the garlands of flowers, only a little withered, as if placed here in love and grief only yesterday, and the sight of a worn oaken staff leaning against the wall, of two pairs of sandals, a new and an old, of favorite joints of meat placed neatly in boxes as if for a journey. Whatever he had expected, it was not this intimate look of home, of a well-loved room to which its owner might at any moment return. Whatever horrors haunted the passage, they were not here in this quiet sanctuary.
Who was the owner?
Ronefer's eyes searched farther and halted in surprise. There were two owners. Slowly, soundlessly, he crossed the chamber to the pair of silver-inlaid coffins, on the lids of which were sculptured in gold the figures of their occupants, a man and a woman. They lay as if sleeping, side by side, their folded hands eloquent of the same defenseless trust that had caused them to order a sweet-faced servant girl as their only guardian. As Ronefer looked into their quiet golden faces, the stealthy sounds of plundering in the next room became horrible to him. For the first time, he fully understood this crime. He straightened, all his fears gone and in its place hot fury. Those merciless and wicked ones, to break into this sacred place and steal the treasures meant to comfort this old couple through their 3,000 years. Whether rich gold or worn-out sandals, these things belonged to them. No living human had a right to set foot in this chamber, not even the son of Thutra, who meant no harm. Almost, he could hear the helpless fluttering of these old ones' frightened baas. So strong was the sensation that he dropped to his knees in profound apology for his own intrusion. As he did so, he saw something else, a stack of wine jars just beyond one of the coffins. They were capped with linen and sealed with clay, and pressed into the clay was a mark as well known to Ronefer as it was to everyone else in Egypt. It was the personal seal of the great noble Hua, only 2 years dead, the beloved father of Queen Ti. Shocked to his very toes, Ronefer scrambled up and retreated a few respectful steps, involuntarily stretching out his hands toward the coffins in a gesture of homage. Here lay Hua and his cherished wife Tua, the parents of the Queen of Egypt. And here he stood, an insignificant nobody, daring to gaze into their faces. He was acutely, desperately embarrassed. He felt like a dusty urchin trespassing in a palace, which he was. Worse, at any moment those thieves would be in here to wreck and pillage, to tear the gold trim from chairs and chests, to smash the jewel boxes, to break open the beautiful coffins and even strip the wrappings from the royal mummies themselves in search of golden amulets. It must not happen. These old ones should have someone grand and fierce to protect them. They only have me, Ronefer thought. I must do something, anything, go fetch help. He turned and started swiftly toward the entrance hole, too swiftly, for his elbow grazed a little inlaid table and tilted the alabaster vase upon it. He clutched at it wildly, but it fell, shattering on the stone floor with a crash that echoed like the very sound of doom. The small noises in the chamber beyond ceased instantly. Ronefer breathed a prayer to Osiris and flung himself behind the coffins, which was all he had time to do before the torch and Gebu's murderous face appeared in the doorway. "Ast!" came Wenamun's hiss. "I told you we were not alone." "We will be soon," Gebu answered in tones that turned Ronefer cold. He could see their two shadows on the wall, black and clear-cut. Gebu's bulky one, Wenamun's, thin and vulture-shaped behind it. The shadows moved, rippled in deadly silence along the wall, leaped crazily to the rough ceiling and down again as the two began methodically to search the room. The dancing black shapes advanced relentlessly toward the coffins, looming huge as giants as they came nearer. Ronefer's hand groped out blindly and closed on a small heavy object that felt like a jewel box. At that instant, Gebu's rage-distorted face was thrust over the coffin. Ronefer lunged to his feet and hurled the box with all his strength. There was a glittering shower of gems as the box struck Gebu full in the eyes, jarring the torch from his hand. He gave a hoarse cry and staggered backward into Wenamun, who began to scream and curse as he fought the flame that was licking upwards into his cloak. In that one instant of confusion, Ronefer saw his chance. He seized the nearest wine jar and aimed it straight at the blaze. There was a splattering crash and the torch hissed out, plunging the chamber into darkness. With the reek of wine and scorched cloth rising strong about him, Ronefer leaped for the far wall, feeling frantically along it for the entrance hole. Behind him, the dark was hideous with yells and curses, with the sound of splintering wood and jewelry crushed underfoot as the two thieves plunged this way and that over the wine-slippery floor in search of him. Where, in the name of all the gods, was the hole? His fingers met a jagged bit of plaster and, beside it, empty space. In an instant, he was through the hole and stumbling along the black passage, bent double under its crowding roof, banging and bumping into its rough-hewn walls, but running, flying away from the death behind him. The sounds of rage faded as he ran, grew fainter with every bend, then suddenly grew louder. The thieves had found the wall opening too and were after him in the passage. He scrambled around a curve, almost fell, dashed on again and brought up with a stunning impact against solid wall. Walls on three sides of him. Was he trapped? He wasted precious moments seeking a way around the obstruction. Then his hand touched a rough shelf of stone. A step! He had reached the bottom of the entrance shaft much sooner than he had expected, for his headlong flight back had consumed far less time than his first cautious crawling journey. He clawed at the wall, found step after narrow step, and hoisted his trembling body up them one by one. As he put his weight on the last one, it crumbled under him. In a panic, he flung both arms over the top of the shaft and for a terrible moment hung there. Then, wriggling, straining, pushing, he was over the top and through the crevice in the rocks. The sunlight hit him like a blow. Half blind and shaking all over, he could think only of that last crumbled step and what it could mean to him. The thieves might climb past by jumping and then wriggling as he had done, but they could not get out if the top of the shaft were solidly blocked. They would have nothing to stand on to shove away the stones. He could hear stumbling, rapid footsteps approaching the bottom of the shaft, and Gebu's enraged voice bellowing his name. But already he was grabbing up rocks as fast as he could move, his eyes squinted tight against the glare of day. He hurled a few into the shaft and felt a fierce joy at the roar of pain below, and the thud of someone falling. Quickly, he wedged some larger stones into the crevice, then began to shove and strain at the biggest, a boulder 3 times the size of his head, which had originally blocked the entrance. It would not budge. He put his shoulder to it, dug his toes into the hot sands, and shoved with all his strength. It stirred a little, tilted. He heard more scrambling sounds below and gave one last desperate thrust. The boulder tipped and rolled across the opening. For a moment, he could do nothing but lean upon the boulder and gasp for breath. There was still space behind it, but he could push it no closer. Unwilling, it would delay them a little while, but that was all. He turned and started running across the red wasteland of the valley in the direction of the Nile. After the closeness of the tomb, the hot, free wind of the desert poured over him like the breath of life itself, but he could take no joy in it. If only the stone had rolled closer, there would be time to plan, to act in safety. But there was no time. There was nothing but more and more danger. Gebu was strong as Set himself. Sooner or later, the stone would be tilting, moving, rolling free. Chapter 15. Hecate and the Ancient had reached the path that led up to the cliffs. Tired, sweaty, and weighted with fear for their friend, they paused for a moment to rest, then started with dragging feet up the stony trail. At the first bend, where the path crooked about on itself and led behind a jagged outcrop of rock, Hecate stopped again to look out across the empty red expanse which had defeated them. One hopeless glance, and he turned to follow the old man. Then suddenly he turned back, squinted, shaded his eyes with cupped hands. An instant later, he let out a yell of excitement. "Ancient, ancient, ancient! Look yonder!" As the old man whirled and hurried back to him, Hecate grabbed his arm and pointed. "There, beyond that line of rocks that looks like a crocodile, isn't that someone running, isn't it?" "It is," said the ancient. They stood motionless, peering toward the distant figure, which vanished behind boulders, reappeared briefly in clear stretches of sand, only to be hidden from them again. Presently, however, it was close enough for them to be certain it was a boy and not a man. "It's Ron-Effer! It must be him!" Hecate cried. He turned and plunged recklessly down the path, with the ancient behind him. A moment later, he was running across the sands toward the place he had last seen the figure, shouting Ran-Effer's name and waving his arms like banners. At the second shout, the figure emerged from behind an outcrop, stared, then almost flew the remaining distance between them.
"Hecate! Hecate!"
Ran-Effer reached his friend and fell upon him.
"How did you get here? What are you doing in this place? Oh, ancient!"
As the old man came hobbling up, Ran-Effer flung his arms around him and burst into tears.
"Ah, young one,"
The ancient groaned and hugged him hard.
We guessed you had come here. We've been searching and searching. But where were you hiding?
Hecate broke in.
What have you been doing? Look at you, all dirt and scratches.
I've been in the tomb, after those cursed ones. They're still there. I've trapped them, but I doubt it will hold them long. I could not push the boulder tight enough.
Oh, ancient, it is the tomb of the queen's father and mother, honored Hua and Tua.
You trapped the thieves, you say?
The ancient pushed him away and seized his shoulders.
Trapped them where? Speak quickly.
As coherently as he could, Ronefer panted out his story.
Do you see? The two of them dug that passage long ago. They've been biding their time, stealing from wreck and breaking into other tombs, too. I found a goblet that proves it. It's in the scroll room at the shop this minute, but I can't find it. I can't find it anywhere.
Never mind the goblet. Where is this stone? I'll wager Hecate and I together can make it move.
Aye, and we'll guard the place while you fetch help.
Hecate's eyes were shining. He looked as if he had never been tired in his life.
Make haste, show us.
It is yonder.
Ronefer pointed, then scrambled to the top of a massive boulder and beckoned Hecate up beside him.
You can see it from here. Look, that pile of rocks with the slanted flat one balanced on top. Do you see it? Ancient, it is the place where that vulture flew up.
Vulture?
Ronefer gazed at him, wide-eyed, then with an expression so peculiar that Hecate frowned and caught his arm.
What ails you? Take care, Ronefer. Don't fall.
I won't.
Vulture? Well, no matter. I am glad he flew. Otherwise, I would never have known.
Come, hurry. Did you note the way well? There is a crevice behind that rock pile, with stones before it.
We'll find it,
Hecate said as they jumped to the ground.
Won't we, ancient? You can depend on us.
Farewell, then, but be careful. Those two devils, they have knives, I think.
Nay, I will come with you.
What use would that be?
Go, go, fetch help.
Hecate gave him a shove and turned away. Reluctantly, Ronefer started toward the hill, then whirled back, stricken.
Aye, but where shall I go to fetch it? Oh, mother of Amun, everybody will be across the river watching the procession, and no one would listen anyway. It is the same as before.
The others frowned, then came back to him.
They must listen, the ancient said. Tell them you have been into the tomb.
Tell who? And how can I get them to believe me? They will think I am spinning tales.
You brought nothing from the tomb? No proof?
Nay, nothing. Nothing.
The goblet, Hecate said.
If you showed the goblet.
I told you, I cannot find it.
Perhaps it is not even there.
Oh, if Zau were at his house today, or Rek.
Nay, Rek is not. That I know. But Zau might be, Hecate exclaimed.
He is an old man, Ronefer. He might not have gone across the river.
I will try. It is all I can do.
Farewell. Osiris, guard you.
And you.
The ancient's voice came floating after him as he sped away.
I should not leave them here with those two devils, Ronefer thought as he forced his tired legs over the sands and up into the hill trail.
A glance back, at the first bend in the path, showed him their small figures hurrying along in the distance, straight for the rock pile.
What if Gebu had pushed that stone away already?
What if they had to face him and that keft of a Wenamun as they crawled out of the shaft?
They would never survive it, not an old man and a boy inexperienced at dodging blows.
Oh, I must go back, cried one part of Ronefer.
But the rest of him said, nay, go on. On he went, trying to forget the danger in which he had placed his dearest and only friends. Pain tore at his side and his lungs felt as if they would burst by the time he reached the summit of the hill. He hurried past the place of the broken tree, past the shelf that had saved his life, and down the narrow, winding cleft up which he had crept so fearfully an hour or so ago. It seemed more like a year ago. He himself felt a different person from the boy who had started out this morning. That boy had been an infant, a know-nothing, a frightened fool, thinking he had real troubles. He had not even known what troubles were. Reflecting bitterly on that ignorant morning self, Ronefer emerged at last into the open sands at the foot of the cliffs. He stopped, leaned against the rocks, and gulped for breath. There before him lay Egypt, green and familiar, with the Nile glinting beyond the houses of the city of the dead. "Zau will not be home," he thought with hopeless certainty. "He will be feasting with all the others. If there were a boat at the docks, but even if I found one and some paddles inside it and got across the river somehow, foolishness, I could not paddle a boat across the Nile now, not all alone. It is too high and swift. And even if I could, how would I find Zau in the crowds? All Thebes is over there, and all half drunk by now, I'll wager. I will go to his house. I must try that at least." He set out across the strip of desert, running until the pain in his side returned, walking until it went away, then running again. At the outskirts of the city of the dead, he turned southward on the first street in the area of villas and gardens near the palace, then eastward toward the river until he recognized the Street of Good Fortune curving off to his right. A few minutes later, he was trying Zau's gate, rattling it frantically when it resisted him, and finally pounding and pounding on it. He gave up at last, let his hands drop heavily to his sides, and stood with tears in his eyes, gazing at the gold sign worked into the grill and the purple vines spilling over it. He turned away and started aimlessly along the empty street. All he had accomplished was to place his friends in mortal danger, then run away and leave them. There was no one even to hear his tale, much less listen and believe. All these houses were as empty as the street. The whole city was deserted. His gaze traveled sadly over the blank, deaf walls, the closed gates and indifferent trees, and reached the palace looming far ahead at the street's end. Then it suddenly riveted. The palace! It was not deserted. Not until midday, at the height of the festival, would the royal procession embark for Thebes and the Temple of Amun. Even as he broke into a trot, he knew it was hopeless, worse than hopeless. How could he get into the palace? The guards would never let him pass. He would never be allowed to tell what he knew. He would die at the gates or else later when Gebu escaped and found him. He did not turn back. His mind filled again with the memory of a quiet chamber deep under the earth, now wrecked and looted, with its helpless occupants still in danger of destruction. Renewed fury drove away the last shreds of his caution. He ran down the empty street, forbidding himself to think of anything but covering the distance he had to cover. At last he arrived, breathless, at the palace wall and glared at it. "So I am to die," he thought furiously. "So be it. I will die now, at once, and not wait for Gebu's help. But first, I will yell out some of it. Some of it!" Discarding all thought of approaching the main gates, he ran in the opposite direction along the wall until he found a tall palm growing near it. After a moment's inspection, he leaped to its rough trunk and crawled up it like a cat, swayed precariously outward on a thick frond, and dropped to the top of the wall. Beneath him, inside the wall, he saw a courtyard edged with sheds and stables. There were three chariots glittering with gold, and a dozen grooms who were bedecking horses with plumes and flowers for the coming procession. None of them looked up. Crouching, Ronefer crept along the top of the wall to the next courtyard. This one was lined with the stalls of the palace weavers and basket makers and potters and bakers, but there was no one in sight. After a moment's intent listening, Ronefer could hear no movement from inside the workshops. This was the place to enter. Swallowing, he hesitated, then dropped to the palm-thatched roof of one of the stalls and from there to the pavement. His heart was thundering so that he felt sure someone would hear it. With a quick glance around, he started across the open space toward a gate in the opposite wall, which seemed likely to bring him closer to the palace itself. Suddenly, a voice bellowed out behind him. "Hi! Halt there! Who is that? Stop, I say!"